The team was finishing their evening meal when Kane appeared in the doorway.
Archangel, Musashi, you're up.
Up? For what?
The sun was already down, and it was hours past the time that they usually fought in the ring. Given that, she couldn't imagine what Kane wanted with her and the gruff Asian fighter seated down the table from her.
For what? To fight, of course.
But it's dark out.
Thank you, Captain Obvious. Now get off your ass and get your gear. You've got a fight to win.
Kane left the room, followed quickly by Musashi. Gabrielle took one last bite of her meal and then pushed back from the table. As she headed for the exit, Valkyrie grabbed her arm.
Watch him. He's got a habit of sacrificing his partners if necessary. Don't let him get behind you if things aren't going well.
Gabrielle nodded, grateful for the advice, but at the same time unsurprised to hear it. It had always been a dog-eat-dog world in her view, but things had gotten decidedly worse since the coming of the demons. She'd take Valkyrie's advice, but she was dismayed that she'd have not one but two opponents to worry about once she entered the arena. She changed in the locker room and then met Kane at the mouth of the tunnel that led to the arena. Kane handed over their weapons. The Templar sword to Gabrielle and a two-handed battle axe to Musashi. Gesturing for them to follow, Kane turned and headed into the tunnel. As Gabrielle attempted to follow, Musashi stepped in front of her.
Stay out of my way if you want to live.
Gabrielle felt her anger rise, and it took considerable restraint to keep her from walking up behind him and punching him in the back of the head. It wasn't what he said to her that had her riled up, but rather the lack of coordination and planning. They were entering the arena as a team, and both of them would have a greater chance of survival if they took even a few moments to discuss how they would handle whatever it was the regent decided to throw at them. But no, Mr. Arrogant clearly thought he was a better fighter than she was, and he didn't need her help. We'll see how that goes, Gabrielle thought, as she fell in step behind the others. If he didn't want to combine forces, then she'd just have to find a way to survive on her own, just as she had every time she'd entered the arena. Tonight's no different than any other fight, she told herself, unaware of just how wrong she was. She caught up to Musashi and Kane at the end of the tunnel where they stood before the gate, waiting for it to rise and allow the two fighters entrance into the arena. Musashi didn't even turn to look at her, but Kane gave her a nod of encouragement, which helped Gabrielle tap her anger back down. She needed to focus, and anger wouldn't help her do that, she knew. A moment passed, and then the iron gate rose. She and Musashi marched across the sands towards the VIP dais on the far side. Through the open roof above their heads, she could see a smattering of stars, and the night air was cool on their skin. Around the edge of the arena, torches burned in sconces attached to the outer wall, providing lighting, but not nearly enough for Gabrielle's satisfaction. Much of the arena floor was at least partially covered in shadows, especially the area in the center, and that made her nervous. It was always harder fighting in semi-darkness. You could never be certain you were seeing everything your opponent was doing. In addition, the floor of the arena seemed higher in relation to the walls surrounding it than it usually did. She glanced back and forth between the walls and the floor a couple of times, wondering what possible reason there could be to raise the floor several feet, and then dismissed it all as nothing more than a trick of the light. The seats surrounding the arena were full, the crowd shouting and jeering so loudly that it all blended into a wall of sound. Gabrielle tuned it out and turned instead to face the VIP platform. There were several figures up there tonight, more it seemed than usual, and she wondered about that. Was something special planned, or was this what a night fight typically looked like? She didn't know, and that worried her. Musashi glanced at her and then raised his weapon in salute to those on the dais, just as they were required to do at the start of every match. Gabrielle followed suit seconds later, and then the two of them moved a short distance away from each other, preparing for one of the gates around the arena to open and admit their opponents. For several long moments, nothing happened. She could see Musashi getting more anxious as the minutes passed without any sign of their opponents. He glanced in her direction several times, but after he ignored her return shrug the first time, she did what she could to ignore him, not wanting his antics to distract her. After what felt like forever, however, Musashi finally lost it.
Fine, I'll just fight you then!
He turned, intent on heading in her direction, it seemed. But before he could take more than a few steps, Gabrielle watched over his shoulder as a section of the arena floor behind him rose silently, pushed upward by a monstrous spider from out of her worst nightmares. It was the size of an ox, with grayish-brown hair that seemed sharp enough to slice flesh on its own, and a massive body supported by multiple legs. Four massive mandibles jutted from the space around its mouth, and it had so many eyes on the upper part of its face that Gabrielle stopped counting at 12. As she looked on, a thick, glistening thread of webbing shot out of a slot beneath the creature's mouth like a bullwhip, wrapping itself around Musashi's legs. He looked down in shock just as the spider scuttled backward, descending back down into the hole from which it had emerged, dragging him off his feet and pulling him towards its den.
Help! Help me!
Gabrielle rushed forward and threw herself down on her knees in front of him. She grabbed his outstretched arms and pulled as hard as she could in the other direction, hoping to tear him free of the webbing wrapped around his legs. She might as well have tried to pull a train down the tracks with her bare teeth. Despite her best efforts, Musashi didn't even move an inch in her direction. She leaned forward, preparing to pull again, only to have him ripped free of her hands when the spider at the other end of the webbing gave a tug of its own. He shot backward, halving the distance to the opening in a single tug.
Do something!
What the hell do you think I'm trying to do?
She grabbed her sword from the sand beside her, climbed to her feet, and raced past him to where the webbing lay stretched out on the sand. She raised her weapon above her head and brought it slashing down against the webbing, expecting it to sever cleanly. Instead, the edge of the blade bounced off the webbing, as if it were made of solid steel. Her arm shook savagely from the impact, and it was all she could do to keep the sword from flying out of her hands. She stared down at the spot she'd struck with her weapon and saw that the blow had delivered the slightest of tears to the material. Realizing as she did so that it would take hours for her to cut through the material at this rate, Musashi didn't have anywhere near that long. She turned, intending to race past him and strike again, when the sudden sense that she was in danger struck like a tidal wave, nearly overwhelming her with its intensity. Reacting on instinct, she threw herself to the side without hesitation, feeling something brush against her bare skin as she went. A thick leg covered in spiked hair slammed to the ground where she'd been standing just a second before, even as she landed in a somersault and rolled back to her feet. She spun about and spotted a second trap door just a few yards away from her, the massive form of a second spider jutting out of the opening, its mandibles clicking back and forth in frustration at having missed her. Never having been one to shy away from a fight and finally having a target to take her growing frustration and fear out on, Gabrielle didn't hesitate, lashing out with her sword at the leg that had just missed her. Unlike the webbing she'd struck earlier, the creature's actual flesh was less resilient, and her sword cut deep this time, sending black blood spewing from the wound. The spider shrieked in pain and attacked in turn, driving its two front legs downward with incredible force in an effort to pin Gabrielle to the ground beneath them. She expected just such a move, however, and was able to twist and turn out of their way each time, swinging her sword whenever the opportunity presented itself to deliver additional wounds to the beast. After a few difficult moments, the creature apparently decided that a full frontal assault was a lot harder way to eliminate an opponent than attacking in secret from behind, and it gave up for the time being, retreating back down into the safety of its hole before disappearing from sight. Gabrielle spun about and was just in time to see Musashi disappear over the lip of the other hole, dragged out of sight by the first of their attackers.
No!
She started after him, only to stutter to a halt after a few steps when she realized the futility of what she was doing. There was no way she was going down into the darkness of that tunnel after him. Musashi was gone, she told herself. There wasn't anything she could do at this point. As if to punctuate her thoughts, there came a long, winding cry from deep within the depths of the tunnel, and then silence fell. She hadn't liked him very much, but she still wouldn't have wished such a death on even her worst enemy. She turned slowly, no longer watching the gates leading into the arena, but casting her gaze over the sand covering the floor of the arena instead. Now she understood why it seemed higher than it usually was. They'd raised it to account for the spider tunnels they'd constructed beneath. A glance at the trap doors lying discarded by each hole showed them to be nothing more than wooden slats nailed together and covered with sand for camouflage. Questions flooded her mind. Just how extensive were the tunnels beneath the sands? How many more exits were there? Were there just the two spiders she'd seen so far? Or were there more waiting to make an appearance? And more importantly, how the hell was she going to kill them? She didn't have answers for any of it. Her hand brushed against her thigh and came away with some thick, clear mucus from where the spider's leg had brushed against her own. Surprised, she brought her hand up closer to her face in an effort to get a better look at whatever the hell it was, and was struck with a pungent scent that reminded her of rubbing alcohol. A thought surfaced from somewhere deep in the back of her mind. Alcohol burns. Just that quickly, a plan was formed. The only thing left to do was to see if it worked. She spun around and searched the wall for the closest torch. She found one, way up near the top, and knew at a glance that it was going to be close. You can do this, she told herself, and ran straight for it, timing her approach so that she planted her foot against the wall itself and shoved herself upward, sword outstretched. Her leap was just high enough. Her sword caught the torch along its length, knocking it free of the sconce in which it was set and sending it tumbling to the sand below. Thankfully, the oil on the torch kept the flames burning even after they dropped into the sand, and Gabrielle snatched it up in her free hand after picking herself up off the ground from her leap. Holding the torch high, she ran for the nearest spider hole. Up close, the pungent smell was even stronger, and she realized that her guess had been right. The sides of the tunnel were liberally coated with the stuff, no doubt to make it easier for the spider to make its way through the labyrinth constructed for them. Gabrielle smiled. All right, you asshole, she thought. Let's see how you like this. She reached down and brought the torch in contact with the side of the tunnel just inside its mouth. A wall of flame rose in response, lighting up the night like a beacon, and Gabrielle smiled as she realized that the flames were headed in the other direction as well, racing deeper into the tunnel beneath the sand as it followed the mucus lining its sides as unerringly as if it had been coated with gasoline. From somewhere underground came a rising shriek as the flames found at least one of her adversaries.
Got you, fucker!
She turned, intent on reaching the other opening to ignite that one as well, but hadn't taken more than a dozen steps in that direction before a spider burst through it, enveloped in flames and screaming in a deafening voice. It charged forward like a runaway freight train, directly at her, and Gabrielle barely had time to throw herself to the side before it plowed over the spot she'd been standing in seconds before. That it was blind and half-mad from pain became clear in the next moment as it spun about, pounding its legs repeatedly into the sand around it and firing webbing in every direction as it sought to find the creature that had dared to harm it so. Because she'd just thrown herself to the ground, the first volley sailed over her head. For a moment, she debated staying right where she was, hugging the sand on the floor of the arena, knowing there was a lower chance of getting struck by those errant pieces of webbing if she did so. If it hadn't been for the fact that the spider was still scurrying about, slamming its legs into the earth with deadly force, she might have done just that. As it was, she knew she had a better chance of avoiding the creature's blows if she was on her feet. She did what she could to stay out of its way, hurrying around behind the creature where it would have a harder time finding her, and waiting for the fire to do the work for her. Unfortunately for Gabrielle, one of those errant shots eventually found her, even as she tried to skip out of the way, the webbing wrapping around her thighs and knocking her off her feet. The moment the spider felt the tug of something caught in its web, it found a focus for all its pain and anger. Turning, it began to move in her direction, struggling against its own injuries and pain, but apparently determined to make her pay for what she had done to it. The flames that were still burning across the surface of its body quickly spread to the lengths of webbing, racing down their length toward Gabrielle, the sticky coating acting as a kind of accelerator for the fire, even as the spider continued doing what it could to haul its hulk in her direction as well. She began desperately hacking at the webbing with her sword, fighting to free herself before the massive beast could reach her. The fire made the webbing more susceptible to the strike of her blade, and she could see it parting beneath the blows even as the flames reached her legs, burning her flesh. Gabrielle used one hand to scoop sand onto the flames, trying to smother them while swinging her sword savagely with the other. The spider, a mere 10 feet away at this point, finally collapsed, its legs no longer able to support its weight. For a moment, Gabrielle thought the fight might have gone out of it entirely, but seconds later she felt herself being pulled in the creature's direction as it began pulling its prey toward itself via the long strands of webbing.
Die, damn you!
In the end, it was the spider that added the final piece to the puzzle to allow her to break free. By pulling on the ends of the webbing, it stretched the strands to their tightest point, allowing the blows Gabrielle delivered to them to do even more damage with every strike. After a few more blows, the webbing finally broke with a sharp sound. Freed from being pulled closer, Gabrielle cut through the final singed strands that were wrapped around her legs. Using her sword as a crutch, she levered herself to her feet and staggered over to the nearest gate before collapsing, the pain and exhaustion finally getting the better of her. The next thing she knew, she was being carried on a stretcher through the hallways beneath the arena, no doubt headed for the infirmary. She'd seen too many other fighters make the same trip not to recognize where she was headed. The pain in her legs was still there, but they must have given her something because it had faded into the background a bit, leaving her able to think outside the pain. Her thoughts seemed crystal clear, but she knew she was fading in and out because she was viewing events around her as if they were individual staccato moments in time rather than a continuous stream. Valkyrie staring down at her, smiling.
You're gonna be okay.
The lights in the hallways passed one after another above her. Thor was suddenly there, grinning down at her.
Keep fighting like that and you're sure to capture Belaziel's attention.
And then he was gone, lost in their wake as they rushed into medical. After that, things got hazy for a while. When she came to again, Valkyrie was applying a noxious-smelling salve and bandages to the burns the webbing had left on her legs. Gabrielle's thoughts turned to what Thor had said as they'd carried her past in the hallway.
What was Thor talking about? Who is Belaziel?
Thor's an idiot.
Well, yes, but that's not an answer.
No, I don't suppose it is.
Valkyrie took another moment to finish what she was doing and then sat back, surveying her handiwork with a critical eye.
That should do the trick. The salve might smell like the devil's ass, but it works like a charm, and your leg should be back to normal in a day or two. As for your question, Belaziel is the demon prince of North America.
One of the seven, Gabrielle thought, and her heartbeat quickened.
Why would I want the demon prince to notice me?
You don't, unless you're an idiot like Thor. It was Belaziel who ordered the construction of the arenas and the creation of the fighting corps. He apparently took a cue from Vespasian, the Roman emperor. Or maybe it was the other way around, I don't know. Bottom line is that he likes to watch us die in unique and varied ways and travels the country looking for fighters worthy enough to face his champion.
And Thor thinks that's a good thing?
Rumor is that if you're lucky enough to defeat the prince's champion, he'll be promoted to take his place.
And I assume there are some perks to being the prince's champion, aside from the opportunity to die in the arena for his amusement.
You assume correctly, if you can ignore the first little bit. Life at the prince's court in Las Vegas is supposed to be rather luxurious, if you live to enjoy it.
She didn't care about the luxury, but access to the prince and his court was something else entirely. The information she could gather in such a place would no doubt prove invaluable to the Templar resistance. Who knew? It might even provide the intelligence that would ultimately let them begin to throw off the yoke that held them all in thrall to the demons. Right then and there, Gabrielle decided that if the opportunity presented itself, she'd take it, and to hell with the consequences. Staring at the piles of treasure filling the chamber in front of him, Cade could almost imagine that he stumbled onto a dragon's hoard hidden deep beneath the earth. Piles of coins and gemstones and gold-plated furnishings were seemingly everywhere, shining in the light from the dozen or more torches held in sconces on the walls, lighting up the room, adding to the suggestion of some fantasy setting. But treasure wasn't the only thing in the room. On the far side of the cavern was a dais that rose several steps above the floor. In the center of that dais was a throne hewn from what appeared to be a single piece of solid black stone, and rising up behind it, like a snake waiting to strike, loomed an enormous pile of human skulls, their empty eye sockets staring at Cade, as if daring him to come closer. The chair and its gruesome company were not the strangest things in the room, however. No, that honor went to the individual currently lounging across that throne, head and arms hanging over one side, legs and bare feet over the other. He was otherwise dressed in black trousers, a white shirt, and a dark vest with what appeared to be a frock coat draped over one section of the nearby skulls. On his head was a wide-brimmed black hat, giving him the appearance of an old-time preacher who'd just stepped out of the Old West. As Cade stepped into view, the other man started, as if surprised that anyone should venture into this place, and then spun about to sit properly on the throne.
My, my, my. What have we here?
For a moment, all Cade could see were the dark holes in the man's face where his eyes should have been. Then he shook himself, as if freeing himself from some invisible hold the other had upon him.
I've come for the answer.
The empty-eyed preacher popped off the throne like a marionette on a string and stood staring at Cade, a wide grin on his face that instead of being reassuring just made him seem all the more predatory.
Well, then if it's the answer you want, I'll give it to you then. 42.
42?
Yes.
42 what?
No what. Just 42. That's the answer.
Cade had read enough Douglas Adams to know the preacher was fucking with him.
I'm not looking for the meaning of life.
Aren't you now?
No, I'm not. As I told you, I'm looking for the answer.
Cade didn't know who this strange fellow was, but one thing was clear. He was not Mictlantecuhtli, the Aztec god of death, which either made him a usurper in this place or made this place a false representation of the Aztec underworld. Either way, that meant Cade should be careful, because he didn't know exactly who or what he might potentially be bargaining with. Not wanting to inadvertently stick his foot into a bear trap without realizing it, Cade turned to where he could keep an eye on the other while scanning the room around him, searching for the sword. He'd only just started when the empty-eyed preacher spoke up again.
It's Fragorok you want then, am I right?
Surprised, Cade turned and looked at the other, who in the blink of an eye had crossed half the room without Cade noticing him doing so. Careful, Cade told himself. Whatever this thing is, it certainly isn't human. Or at least, not anymore if it had been at one time. Rather than answering the question directly, he spoke around it.
What's it to you what I'm after?
Just so happens that I'm in a position to help you find the sword. If you'll help me in return, that is.
Help you? To do what?
Ah, well, therein lies the rub. I don't rightly know just what I'll need help with. Not yet, anyway. But I'm willing to take a marker for your help at a later date when I figure out exactly what that help should be. Deal?
The preacher stuck out his hand, looking for Cade to shake on it. Cade, however, didn't move. He had no intention of making a deal with this creature, especially one for an unspecified service at a later date, and the idea of shaking hands with him made his skin crawl.
I reject your offer. I'll find the blade myself.
Oh, I don't think so. Not when there are so many to choose from.
With a wave of his hand, the piles of gold and jewels and precious metals all began to shift and churn, as bladed weapons of every shape and form rose to the surface. From daggers and dirks to swords and scimitars, they rose like skeletons released at last from their coffins, clawing their way to the surface so they could visit their living relatives and show them how much they missed them. Some were bare blades, some were in worn leather sheaths, but all of them seemed to call his attention in their direction, like the blades were singing a siren call that beckoned him to pick them up and make them his own. Cade shook his head and felt his own power rise in response to the charm the preacher was trying to force on him. A glance at the preacher showed him staggering backward as if he'd been struck, and when he caught his footing and glared back at Cade, the Templar got the sudden feeling that he'd just made an enemy. An enemy of the kind that it really wasn't wise to make. Cade didn't care. He'd come here for one thing and one thing only, and he'd be damned if he'd let this Old West freak show keep him from getting it. If the preacher wanted a fight he'd get. Thankfully, the other made no move toward him, and after a moment, Cade turned back to the reason he was here in the first place. Looking out over the sea of weapons, he knew there was no way he was going to be able to check them all by hand. He'd be here till the end of time if he tried to do that. He needed a way to eliminate all but the most likely of possibilities. From what he'd read about Fragorach, it seemed logical to classify it as an enchanted weapon, which would certainly make it stand out against all the others if he used his sight. If he discovered more than one that appeared to be enchanted, he'd just take them all and sort the right one out later. As much as he didn't want to do it, Cade turned his back so that the preacher was behind him. Something instinctively told him he didn't want to see the other's true form, and so he wanted to be certain, despite the risk involved, that he wouldn't accidentally get a glimpse of him when he activated his sight. Satisfied, he moved his eye patch to one side and mentally tripped that switch in his head that allowed him to see into the supernatural realm around him. The beyond was always a dark, more corrupt version of the place where he entered it, and this cavern deep below the earth was no exception. The treasures around him seemed to be coated with a dark, oily substance, a physical representation of the greed they engendered in those who sought after them, and the various piles seemed to be connected by thick cobwebs, a symbol of the way they snared and entrapped their prey. Ignoring it all, Cade cast about, searching for the sword, hoping it would blaze brighter than the objects surrounding it due to its enchanted nature, but he did not find it. He could sense the preacher's presence, creeping closer behind him, but he refused to turn in that direction. Knowing that's exactly what the other wanted him to do, knowing he'd be trapped somehow if he did so. He cast his gaze farther across the room, mentally urging the sword to show itself. As if in response, the Seeker Stone hanging around his neck suddenly burst into life, sending a brilliant blue beam of light lashing across the torch-lit room, skewering a battered leather sheath sticking out of the edge of a pile of scattered copper coins. It was perhaps the least impressive-looking weapon in the entire room, and yet Cade knew immediately that he'd found the treasure he'd come looking for. High King Nuada's sword, Fragorach. Behind him, he heard the preacher shout an alarm. Cade dropped his sight and spun about, his hand going to the sword strapped across his back, ready to defend himself against the thing, whatever it was. But he needn't have worried. The preacher was stumbling away from him, his hands covering his eyeless face, and Cade realized in that moment that the magic at the Seeker Stone had somehow injured the other. Serves the bastard right, Cade thought, as he turned away and made his way across the chamber to where he'd spotted the sword. He grabbed it by the hilt and dragged it free of the coins. It didn't look like anything special. The hilt was simple and unadorned. The leather scabbard in which it rested was stained and worn. But the moment he touched the weapon, he felt a call ring through his soul. A wild cry that made him want to wade into battle. A pounding of his heart and a stirring in the spirit that cried for the old ways. The ways of blood and bone and warfare. This was Fragorach, and it was tired of wasting away beneath the earth. For a moment he was tempted to draw it forth, to let the blade breathe free in the air for the first time in who knew how long, but something held him back. Perhaps the blade was just a bit too eager to free itself. Whatever it was, he fought back against the urge and kept it securely in its sheath. Turning, he found the preacher watching him intently from only a few feet away. Once again, he had managed to get closer to Cade without the other man hearing him come. In a room where every footstep rang with the clink of coins beneath your boots, that was an impressive feat. Sneaky bastard, Cade thought. Thankfully, he didn't need to remain here for another moment. Casting about, he caught sight of a large ornate mirror leaning against a nearby pile of treasure. Walking over to it, he pulled it loose with his free hand, refusing to let go of Fragorok with his other now that he'd found it. Placing the mirror flat on the floor, reflective side up, he gave the preacher one final contemptuous look, and then stepped through the glass, intent on making his way home via the mirror's road. As Cade stepped over the threshold, the preacher made his move. Due to the nature and method of his confinement, he wasn't able to create a gate on his own, but that didn't preclude him from using one created by someone else, like the one the idiot Templar had just opened right in front of him. And once he had passed through the gate into the beyond, he would be free to exit where and when he saw fit, including at any point in the future or the past, thanks to certain innate abilities of his own. The thought of escape made him near giddy with excitement. He had a score to settle with a certain blind ghost whisperer, and he was determined to have his account book stamped and paid in full. Cade was only halfway through the gate when the preacher crashed bodily into him from behind, shoving him forward and down onto his hands and knees. It was so unexpected that it took a moment for his brain to catch up and understand what had just happened. He staggered to his feet, his free hand going to the hilt of Fragorok, ready to draw it in his defense. But it turned out to be unnecessary. The preacher had shoved him not to cause harm, but simply to get him out of his way. The other man was already headed away from Cade, hurrying away across the causeways of the beyond to who knew where. Cade let him go. He had no desire to tangle with whatever the hell the preacher was. Satisfied that his mission was over, Cade turned for home. Over the next week, Gabrielle fought several more times in the arena. She was alone more often than not, but on two occasions she fought with Valkyrie at her side. The other woman was a solid fighter and a force to be reckoned with. Gabrielle was not looking forward to the day when they would find themselves on opposite sides of the fight with a crowd shouting for their blood. She would hate to kill the one friend she had in this forsaken place, but she'd do it if she had to. Kill or be killed. That was the only game being played. Late one night after a particularly grueling match, she was surprised from sleep by the sound of a key turning in the lock on her door. None of the guards had ever disturbed her once the day's activities were finished, and she leapt out of bed into a fighting crouch, ready to defend herself if need be. To her surprise, it was Fightmaster Kane who came through the door, an oil lantern in hand. Gabrielle straightened with a sudden sense of relief when she saw who it was, but then noticed the other woman wasn't alone. Two sets of guards entered the sleeping chamber behind Kane. They spread out to either side of the doorway and stared at Gabrielle as if she were suddenly public enemy number one. She felt her hackles go up at the sight of them, and was about to ask Kane what the hell was going on, when the fifth and final member of the party stepped through the doorway. Gabrielle froze at the sight of him. He stood at least 7 feet tall, possibly more, and had to duck beneath the doorframe as he entered the room. He was built like an NFL running back, with long, trim legs, a muscular torso, and wide shoulders. He wore nothing but a knee-length skirt of the type that had been popularized by ancient Egyptian pharaohs. His skin was as dark as obsidian and gleamed in the light of the lantern as if he'd been recently oiled. But what caused Gabrielle to nearly faint with fear was the fact that atop his neck sat the head of a jackal, with a sharp angular snout of gleaming teeth, red glowing eyes, and pointed ears that rose several inches above his skull. As he straightened, his attention zeroed in on Gabrielle and he stood stock still, staring for a long moment. "Demon," her mind shouted. The fear like a living, breathing thing that was trying to overwhelm her from the inside out even as she fought to remain in control. Her conversation with Valkyrie while in the infirmary came back to her, and it didn't take much time to put two and two together. This must be Belaziel, one of the seven. Fightmaster Kane gestured in Gabrielle's direction.
"This is Archangel, the fighter you've heard about."
Gabrielle felt like a rabbit caught by the gaze of a wolf. After staring at her for a long moment, the demon opened its mouth and spoke. What came out was no language Gabrielle had ever heard. Instead of words, he issued a series of grunting, barking, and yowling sounds that reminded Gabrielle of the noises made by a pack of angry hyenas. To her surprise, Kane apparently understood it. She nodded to the demon prince, then turned to Gabrielle and gestured at what she was wearing.
This robe.
The command took Gabrielle by surprise. What the hell did she need to disrobe for? Then she remembered how most of the women captured by the Regent's troops were sent to the breeding pens to build the ranks of his Fomori army. Put two and two together, and realized just what the dog-faced demon might be expecting of her. No fucking way, she thought. No way was she letting this thing anywhere near her. She'd go down fighting before she'd let that thing touch her. For just a second, she considered opening a gate then and there and just stepping through it, getting away from this madhouse before things went from bad to worse. She'd learned enough, hadn't she? The information she'd gathered should prove useful to the Templars, shouldn't it? But then, to her surprise, she glanced in Kane's direction and saw the other woman mouth something to her. Just two words, but they were two words she would never have expected the Fightmaster to use, especially in relation to her. "Trust me," Kane mouthed. Even though the words weren't said aloud, there was a look of desperate urgency in Kane's eyes that stopped Gabrielle in her tracks. Whatever was to come, Kane wanted, no, needed for it to happen, and that piqued Gabrielle's curiosity. So far, the Fightmaster had done what she could to protect her, in and out of the ring. It seemed unlikely that she would do something to harm her current prizefighter, as that would diminish the rewards she received from Gabrielle's winnings. To both their surprise, Gabrielle did what Kane asked, sliding the simple shift she wore to bed off her shoulders and letting it fall to a pool at her feet. Belazia looked her over for a moment and then pushed past Kane to stand next to Gabrielle. This close, the hair on the back of her neck and arms stood at attention, and she felt the sudden, nearly overwhelming urge to hide, to get as far away from this creature as she possibly could. She gritted her teeth and forced the feeling into a box in the back of her mind. She'd be damned if she ran off now. The demon reached out with a long-fingered hand and felt the muscles of her upper arm, and then did the same for her nearest thigh. He roughly turned her about, once, twice, checking her over, and occasionally poking her with a sharp claw, testing the muscles beneath her skin. Gabrielle felt like a piece of meat being examined by the butcher, and she didn't want to think too much about how close that comparison might actually be. Finally, after what felt like forever, Belazial made a kind of grunting noise in the back of his throat, and then spoke to Kane in that same barking, yowling voice.
She will be ready, Your Eminence.
Belazial ducked beneath the lintel of the door and left the room, quickly followed by his four bodyguards. Kane waited a moment until the other had made his way down the hall, and then breathed a sigh of relief.
Well done.
What the hell was that about? Who, or what, was that thing? And what did it say?
That thing, as you call him, was Belazial, Prince of North America, the highest-ranking demon on the continent. It seems he heard of the prowess of a fighter named Archangel, and because he's obsessed with anything to do with the arena matches, came to see her for himself.
Gabrielle wasn't sure how she felt about that. She was surprised that her fame had spread beyond the city in which she found herself, especially in this day and age where mass communication had gone the way of the dodo. She wondered just what it was that Belazial wanted with her.
And now that he's had a chance to see me for himself?
He wants you to fight his champion, Crusher, in the arena tomorrow. This couldn't be more perfect.
Gabrielle knew this was the opportunity she'd been hoping for, but she pretended to be considerably less enthused than her companion.
I have to fight some monstrosity named Crusher, and you're excited about that?
And you should be, too. Only the best of the best are chosen to face off against the prince's champion. Imagine the prestige that this could bring to us.
Yeah, if I survive, that is.
Facing off against a dumb animal or low-level demon was one thing. She'd done it enough times to know. She was positive that Crusher, whoever or whatever he was going to be a force to be reckoned with. Earning the position of the prince's champion had most likely not come easy, and every fight he'd survived had no doubt given him experience to use in the next battle.
How long has he been champion?
I can't remember.
You can't remember? He's been champion for so long that you can't remember a time when he wasn't?
No, that's not what I mean. I just haven't been paying attention.
Oh, don't give me that. Nothing happens in this place without you being intimately aware of it. Stop screwing around and tell me the truth. How long has he been champion?
3 years.
3 years? She didn't want to think about how many battles he'd survived in that time frame. How on earth was she going to defeat him? Kane must have sensed what she was thinking, because she rounded on her faster than a striking snake.
Get that out of your head right now. This is our chance out of this place, and we're not going to blow it just because you're afraid of an ugly motherfucker you haven't even met yet. You can do this. You will do this.
Ignoring her demands, Gabrielle focused on the part of her outburst that had caught her attention.
What do you mean, our chance to get out of this place?
Kane's smile turned crafty.
When you defeat Crusher, and you will defeat him, Blasio will make you his new champion. He'll take you to the capital city in Las Vegas. I, of course, will have to go with you as your trainer to keep you in fighting shape so that you remain champion.
While the Fightmaster was focused on improving her status through Gabrielle's hard work, Gabrielle's thoughts went in another direction entirely. Being close to one of the Seven would be an intelligence coup for the Templars, one of an undeniable advantage in the days ahead. Traveling from one location to another would give her unparalleled access to the infrastructure the demons had set up during their conquest, allowing the Templars not only to target specific locations with the kind of detail they'd had difficulty accumulating in the past, but it would also potentially bring them in contact with like-minded individuals within these locations, who might become new allies in their fight against the Seven. How she'd get the information back to the Templars was something she'd have to figure out later, but the chance to provide such valuable intelligence wasn't one to be dismissed easily. Of course, there were the arena contests to consider. She'd have to survive those if her plan was going to be useful over the long run. But at least she had a way out if worse came to worst. Her ability to open a gate out of there gave her an escape route no one would be expecting. She was confident in her skills, but thankful that she had a way out if things went ugly fast. With the Demon Prince gone and her fear starting to subside, Gabrielle was starting to see the advantages of this latest turn of events. Now, all she had to do was beat the Prince's champion. Later that day, Gabrielle was in the middle of sparring with Valkyrie when Fightmaster Kane entered the room and gestured for her to come over. Handing her boken to her partner, Gabrielle grabbed a towel from a nearby attendant and crossed the training floor to where the Fightmaster was waiting.
Follow me, and not a word.
The other woman then turned and left the room, heading down the hallway at a good clip. Gabrielle tossed the towel aside and hustled to catch up. Kane led her through the depths of the arena complex, down a variety of passageways, and through a number of seemingly abandoned access tunnels until they reached a door at the far end of an otherwise innocuous-looking hallway. Behind the door was a stairwell, which took them up several floors to another door.
If we're stuck, I'm taking you to medical for a possible broken rib. Favor your left side and wince if they try to examine you. Understood?
Gabrielle stared at her for a moment, a thousand questions running through her mind, but rather than voice any of them, she simply nodded. As had been the case when Kane had burst into her room earlier that morning, Gabrielle had no idea what the Fightmaster was up to. But whatever it was clear that neither of them was supposed to be here. Based on what she'd said, Kane was putting herself as well as Gabrielle on the line through their very presence here. She assumed it had something to do with the coming fight with the Prince's champion, but it looked like she was going to have to wait to find out. They entered a hallway that stretched away from them in either direction, the slight curve it took suggesting that it ran around the outside edge of the arena proper. Workers in black and gold uniforms were scattered about its length, engaged in various activities, and Kane didn't hesitate, just stepped out amongst them as if she belonged, and headed off with her head high and an expression on her face that suggested anyone who stopped them had better have a damn good reason for doing so. Gabrielle had seen that expression before, and knew there'd be hell to pay if anyone tried to stop them. Thankfully, no one did. They walked about a quarter of the way around the circumference of the arena before Kane stopped in front of a door that looked exactly like all the others. There had once been a nameplate attached, no doubt identifying the room for what it was, but the plate was long since gone, and all that remained was a faded spot on the paint to show it had been there in the first place. How Kane knew it was the one she was looking for was beyond Gabrielle, unless the other woman had counted all those doors they'd passed along the way. The Fightmaster removed a set of keys from her pocket, selected one from the mix, and slipped it into the lock. It turned with a sharp click, and then Kane was ushering her quickly inside. The room was an old broadcaster's booth, from back when the networks would carry the various arena events live on national TV. The metal stands that used to support the cameras were still there, but the rest of the equipment, including the camera themselves, were long since gone. No doubt carted off to be cannibalized for some other projects. The long rectangular window looking out onto the arena floor was still intact, as were the blinds, currently closed, that covered it. A counter stretched the length of the window, all but a section in the middle covered in dust several layers thick. A chair stood before the center section, cleared of dust just like the counter in front of it. A pair of binoculars rested on the seat of the chair.
The controls for the blinds are over there. Open them no more than a quarter of the way, or those on the outside will be able to see into the booth. If that happens, you're on your own. No one is supposed to be in this room, least of all one of the fighters like you. And if you get caught, I'll deny I knew anything about this little excursion.
Okay, great. I don't know you, you don't know me. Fine. Now tell me, what the hell am I doing here?
Kane smiled that wolfish smile of hers and quoted an age-old maxim every fighter knew.
If you know your enemy, and you know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles. Give me a few minutes to get down the hall, and then see for yourself. I'll get back to you once it's all over. Stay here until I return.
With that, she slipped out the door, locking it behind her. This day was getting stranger by the minute, Gabrielle thought. She counted to 50, figuring that was long enough to let Kane get safely down the hall, and she then stepped over to the controls for the blinds. She twisted the knob, heard the groan of long unused machinery, and watched as the slats of the blinds slowly rotated. As instructed, she only let them open one quarter of the way before turning the knob to off. Light flooded into the room from outside. Moving over to the blinds, Gabrielle looked through the narrow openings she created. She found herself looking out into the arena proper from a position exactly opposite the Regent's viewing box, and understood in that moment why Kane had warned her to be careful about being seen. The viewing stand was full of people, including the Regent and Belaziel, their bodyguards and a retinue of fawning sycophants hoping for their attention. All it would take was one errant pair of eyes to spot her through the open blinds and she'd be in deep. She reminded herself to move slowly and not give away her position with sudden movements that might catch anyone's attention. A fight was obviously about to start, for down on the arena floor a trio of gladiators were standing with their backs to each other, facing outward so they could watch the various doors set in the walls surrounding them. In addition to the shorts and boots that the male fighters usually wore, these three were also wearing shirts of chainmail, hundreds of steel rings no bigger than a dime all linked and woven together to provide a layer of protection. Gabrielle was surprised to see the armor. It might help defend against a few blows, but the added weight of the mail would slow the fighters down and limit their dexterity. She wasn't convinced that was worth the trade-off, especially when she got a glimpse of their opponent just seconds later, as a gate to her left rattled open and the Prince's champion stepped into the arena. She'd thought Belaziel was huge, but Crusher dwarfed even him. He had to be at least 8 feet in height, and his shoulders were wide enough to match. Unlike his armored opponents, he wore only a loincloth, leaving much of his body on display. This allowed Gabrielle to see that he looked as if someone had painstakingly peeled away his outer layer of flesh, leaving the ropes of his muscles and tendons clearly exposed. She was reminded of a medical textbook she'd seen in her youth, with illustrations of various body parts arranged on translucent sheets that lay atop one another so you could see how everything fit together. What she could see of Crusher's body was a deep grayish purple in color, adding to the dissonance in looking at him. In his right hand he carried a large mace, its round head the size of a car tire that was covered with gleaming spikes that stuck out in every direction. Getting hit with it probably meant you weren't getting up again, and Gabrielle shook herself to chase away the mental image that conjured up. He lumbered forward, directly toward his opponents, who judiciously decided to split up as they saw what was coming toward them. Grouped together, they'd be nothing more than an easy target, but spread out, with one facing the oncoming threat and the other two drifting to either side of their enemy, they might have a chance. Their movements revealed one of the Fomori's disadvantages. His head seemed to rest right atop his torso, with little to no neck separating them. As the fighters moved to opposite sides, rather than simply turning his head to keep track of them, Crusher had to twist his entire torso in that direction. That will slow his response time, she thought, and log that little detail away for when she had to face him herself. Who knew, it might just save her life. Crusher rumbled forward inexorably like a slow-moving train, and the three challengers moved in to meet him. That was their second mistake. Being there at all was their first, as the next few seconds clearly showed. Fighter number one stood his ground, sword at the ready, waiting for the Prince's champion to get close enough to engage. He did not, however, take the other's longer reach into account. The fighter settled into a combat crouch, sword at the ready, but before he could do anything more, Crusher struck. The arm holding the mace whipped forward with breathtaking speed, thundering down atop the other man's skull before he even apparently understood that he was in danger. One blow was all it took. When Crusher pulled his weapon back, Fighter number one's head was little more than a pulpy red mass smashed into the arena sands. The other two fighters used the momentary distraction to rush forward from either side, no doubt hoping to catch their opponent between them. To Gabrielle's surprise, Crusher was far more quick and agile than she thought he would be. Even as he was pulling his mace back from his initial strike, the Fomori champion spun to his left and kicked out with one leg, catching fighter number two in the gut and sending him flying backward a half a dozen feet to land in a crumpled ball on the sand. Fighter number three had more success, closing the distance between them and stabbing his sword into Crusher's back just below the ribcage, no doubt expecting the blade to sink deep into the unprotected flesh. But to his and Gabrielle's surprise, the hard swath of the erector spinae muscle turned the blade aside as if it had been dashed against cold iron. The blow sent such a violent reverberation down the blade that it sprang free of the fighter's hand and slashed his cheek as it flew past. Crusher roared, though whether from pain or anger at being struck, Gabrielle couldn't tell. The Fomori spun about, the mace in his hand already swinging for his opponent at shoulder level in a sweeping arc, but this time the other man was expecting the attack. He ducked beneath the blow and then skipped backward on shaky legs, getting himself out of Crusher's reach as fast as he could. Unfortunately, this also put him farther away from his dropped weapon, leaving him all but defenseless in the middle of a fight to the death. Not good, Gabrielle thought. But fighter number three got lucky. As he skipped out of reach of his opponent, Crusher decided to take advantage of the moment to eliminate the second of the trio. He sauntered over to where the other man was still lying unconscious in the sand, nudged him with his foot to see if he was playing possum, and then, not receiving a response, raised his mace and brought it smashing down on the other man's unprotected back. Blood flew. There was a horrible squishing sound as Crusher dragged the mace from the other man's body and then smashed it down a second time, and then a third, and a fourth. By the time the Fomori was finished, several swings later, it was hard to recognize the bloody mess on the floor of the arena in front of him as a human body. Gabrielle barely noticed that part of the drama, however. Her attention had been caught by something else she'd noticed. As Crusher lifted his arm to swing the mace, she spotted a lighter-colored section of flesh deep in the center of his armpit. At first, she thought it was just a trick of the light, but she waited for another swing and saw it again. The flesh there was definitely a lighter color. More importantly, it didn't have the same bands of muscle that were so prominent elsewhere on Crusher's body. Now, whether that meant the area was vulnerable to an opponent's strike or simply a different shade of skin, Gabrielle didn't know. She'd have to test it herself when she was in the ring with him. Which was less than ideal, but she didn't have any way of finding out if she was right. Mentally filing the fact away for future consideration, she turned her attention back to the fight. Crusher's distraction with turning his second opponent into jelly allowed fighter number three to retrieve his weapon, but the man's courage had deserted him in the face of the death of his comrades. Rather than strike at Crusher while his back was turned, the other man turned and ran for the nearest gate, apparently thinking he could save himself if he could escape the arena. Gabrielle was surprised at the sight. She'd never even considered trying to get out once she was on the floor of the Proving Ground. Was it due to simple pragmatism, she wondered? A recognition that even if by some miracle she did manage to get out of the arena, there would be nowhere for her to go in a city full of the region's allies? Or just plain stubbornness? An unwillingness to surrender in the face of adversity? She honestly didn't know. One thing was for certain, though. It wasn't a strategy that was going to work. As Gabrielle looked on, the fighter dropped his weapon, gripped the gate, and began pulling on it, doing everything he could to haul it open, forgetting in his frenzy that the gate went up and not out. Behind him, Crusher stopped hammering what was left of his opponent into the ground and turned to look for the one who got away. Spying him near the gate, the Fomori champion began walking leisurely in that direction, dragging his mace through the sand behind him to clean it of the blood and guts that had accumulated on it. The hissing sound the mace made as it slid through the sand caused the other fighter to turn. When he saw Crusher coming toward him, his attempts to get away became more frantic. Rather than pulling at the gate, he decided to try to climb it. Leaping upward, he grabbed two of the bars and hauled his legs up behind him, planting his feet flat against the iron bars. Unfortunately, when he tried to shift his hands higher, his feet slid downward, causing him to tumble back down to the ground. As he climbed to his feet, a glance backward showed that Crusher had lessened the distance between them by half. Gabrielle honestly felt bad for the guy at that point, as his fear pushed all sense of reason aside. She couldn't hear him behind the glass, but she could see his mouth opening and closing as she shrieked in fear. For his sake, she hoped it was over soon. Unable to climb the gate, the fighter flung himself to the ground and frantically tried to dig under it. He was throwing handfuls of sand behind him when Crusher closed the distance, grabbed the guy by the ankle, and began slamming his body against the ground like a sledgehammer. This time, the roar of the crowd came through the glass loud and clear. Gabrielle wanted to look away but forced herself to keep her gaze firmly on Crusher, hoping she'd see something else that might help her in her own fight when she faced off against him the following day. Unfortunately, there was nothing new. Just that light patch under the arms, and the fact that he had to turn his whole body to see to either side or behind him. Advantages, yes, but slim ones. She wasn't sure how she was going to turn them into a win. Unwilling to watch anymore, Gabrielle moved over to the controls and lowered the blinds.